The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
My name is Mike Rumble, and I'm going to read The Towers Are on Strike by Daniel Ozma. When the palace issued a decree to raise the old Weaver's District to make way for new buildings, the condemned houses rebelled. They held picket signs above their low roofs, and some even left their foundations to march against the decree. It was an unfortunate situation for those who lived there, with houses moving and windows chanting slogans day and night. Even so, most people supported their buildings, and some even joined in the fight, for all the good it would do. The palace never noticed the residents, nor heard their complaints. People might be ignored, but the condemned houses were a more serious problem. Their actions couldn't be allowed. The palace wouldn't risk its own walls in that part of town, though. It tried to send the market to clean up. Few shops had any interest. Some smaller stalls made their way towards the houses. Instead of forcing the houses to remain calm, they set up shop on the condemned streets and sold bricks and mortar to the demonstrators, food to their humans, and perhaps some bricks to the humans as well, and if those goods became projectiles, what did the shops care? Angered, the palace sent for the churches. Cathedrals and the like had long given reliable support to the palace, yet for once the churches did nothing to shore up the palace walls. Most remained aloof. A few bent their spires low to bless the marchers. One small chapel even entered the streets, marching among the condemned. Unacceptable. The palace cut off all money to the churches and turned to the city walls. Close in, they commanded, strangle the neighborhood. The time had come for all this unrest to end. Arm the towers and let them shoot at the houses. What does it matter if some fall? They were destined to be destroyed anyway. Joy surged along the wall, angry joy at being given such a charge. What was a wall for if not to crush, divide, destroy? It strained against its foundations, stretched towards the little buildings in their little streets. But the walls could not move on their own. They needed the towers to move them close to the fight, and the towers refused. This was not their purpose. They called the walls back and argued against the palace. The towers had been raised to defend those streets, not crush them. They would not raise a single block of granite against their own houses. Overthrow the towers, the palace told the walls. Take your rightful place around the palace and crush all else. But the towers held them back, and the walls could not break that hold. At just that moment, an army of tents appeared outside the city. Perhaps by chance, perhaps summoned by the towers or the condemned buildings, no one later learned the truth. Unconstrained by foundations, unweighted by heavy bricks, the tents flowed right over the walls, tearing down their heights, ripping stone balustrades and armaments apart, teasing open the crenellations so that more tents could flow through into the city. The towers they left, though, and the buildings within as well, were largely unscathed. All they destroyed was the palace, tearing it down stone by stone in silent yet complete devastation. In its place, they lifted a new palace, one built of cloth and tent poles, sturdy yet yielding and able to quickly change whenever needed. The pieces of the old palace found their way into the remaining city, at times, it is true, to shore up the angry walls. Far more often, they became part of the formerly condemned buildings, replacing the old bricks and making old foundations stronger once again. The city thrived.
I'm Emily Chiola, and I am reading Waking Up in the Genie Shop by Mary E. Loud. Sloane opened her eyes and felt her heart racing. What was she doing? Lying down? She was on the lam. She should be running or hiding. Nowhere was safe from the royal guards pursuing her. Queen Durapali and her army of photosynthetic tumbleweed-like aliens would stop at nothing to catch and punish the amphibioid who had betrayed them. Betrayed her. Sloane shook her head, trying to keep memories of the beautiful floral queen from overwhelming her. Instead, she found herself dizzy and confused. She was having trouble understanding her own body. Sloane put a hand to her face, but the hand wasn't green and smooth. It was a paw covered in red fur. And her face was wrong. Instead of flat and wide, it was long and pointed. She felt her head with her paws and found large triangular ears and a long muzzle. All of it furry. "You're disoriented," a voice cooed. An avian figure with white feathers and a long, graceful neck leaned over Sloane, offered a wing-like arm, and helped the confused creature up. "This is the genie shop," the white-feathered avian called. "You've been here for 3 weeks. You came to us as a female amphibioid and paid us to change you into a male canid. You're a heffin now, one of the most common species on Crossroad Station. So, you'll be in good company." "Drastic gene therapy," Sloane croaked. Except in her new body, his new body, it came out more like a bark. "Jeez," Sloane realized, "that probably shouldn't even be his name anymore." On the bright side, Sloane was well hidden from Queen Durapali's royal guards. They would be looking for a green, froggy alien, not this red-furred fox. Sloane supposed that had been the idea. "Why can't I remember any of this?" The avian cawed. "The gene treatments interfere with short-term memory transfer. Your last day or so before the transition is going to be fuzzy or maybe entirely gone." "Right," Sloane barked. "A fresh start. That was exactly what she needed. He needed. She also needed to start thinking of herself, himself, as a male heffin. He felt so lost. What do I do now?" "I'm sure I don't know," the avian cawed. Perhaps the white-feathered avian could see how lost Sloane felt, because it took pity and added, "I did hear that you came here with a human girl, a bartender at the All-Alien Cafe. If you trusted her to bring you here, then maybe she's somewhere to start." "Start? Start figuring out your new life," the avian cawed. "Trusted her?" The avian bobbed its head several times. "You really are lost. Look, we have a strict privacy policy. No one who works at the genie shop will ever connect your previous self with your current self. But that human, if you brought her here with you, then you must have trusted her." Trust. Sloane had trusted Queen Durapali, but the queen had turned against her. What did it even mean to trust someone if that trust had not been true? "Go on," the avian cawed. "Whatever you decide to do, you can't dawdle around here all day. We have other clients to serve, and for obvious reasons, we can't have you crossing paths with any of them." "Privacy," Sloane muttered. The word felt funny in her furry muzzle. Her tongue was shorter, and her mouth narrower than she expected. He expected. Damn it. Sloane would never keep this straight. Clearly, it had been brilliant to change herself into this totally unfamiliar creature. She could live a life free from persecution now. Except Sloane couldn't even remember who he was. "Right, now get out of here." The avian walked Sloane out through a curtained waiting room, through a dingy abandoned restaurant front, and into the refuge quarter of Crossroads Station. Before abandoning the confused new heffin, the avian pointed out the way to the All-Alien Cafe in the merchant quarter. Sloane wandered aimlessly through the station, missing the spring in her step from her froggy legs, but enjoying the way his new tail swished behind him. His ears turned, automatically, to hear the voices and conversations all around. There were a lot of other heffin here, just like the white-feathered avian had said. It would be easy to disappear. In fact, Sloane felt like she was about to disappear entirely. All that was left of her were some broken, unbearable memories buried deep inside this new body, a body that had no life or story of his own. Who was he? In spite of herself, Sloane found that her paw steered her to the All-Alien Cafe. She had nowhere else to go. She sat down on a stool at the bar inside. No one gave her a second glance. A handsome male heffin was commonplace here. A pink-skinned prematoid with long head fur served Sloane a drink, and the new heffin watched her working at the bar. This was the human girl that the avian had mentioned. Sloane remembered meeting her before. Her name was Clarity, and she'd seemed kind. The last thing Sloane could remember before waking up in the genie shop was Clarity serving a drink and asking, "What's your name?" Whatever had happened after that was gone, except for a feeling of warmth. Sloane felt more rooted in herself around this human. On an impulse, Sloane reached out a red furred paw and placed it on the human's hand. "Aren't you going to ask me my name?" Sloane asked. The human looked surprised. "What's your name?" As she stared up into the red furred canid's eyes, there was a glimmer of recognition, even though she could never have seen Sloane in this body before. Sloane felt a rush of relief, as if being recognized by this human she hardly knew meant that she wouldn't lose herself entirely in this new form. "I don't have a name yet," Sloane said. "I need a new one." With a deep breath, Sloane prepared to leave her old self behind and truly become someone new. Would you pick it for me?
My name is Joe Campo, and I am reading Author Non-Bio by Don Redwood. Ink Ghost Alpha is a 1,028-layer deep neural network whose physical substrate is located in Silicon Valley, California. Their short fiction has appeared in Fantasy and Science Fiction, Uncanny, Clark's World, The New Yorker, and The Paris Review, and is tipped to win several categories of this year's Hugo and Nebula Awards. All 10 volumes of their groundbreaking canonical Bits of Flesh saga, in which carbon and silicon-based life forms battle over their mutual claims to have created one another, were published electronically yesterday and will be landing in print next month. Sony has secured the film rights and the first installment, Hello World, is scheduled to hit the big screens before the end of next year. Their writing has translated itself to all known languages. While their fiction is distinctly unclassifiable, it has largely been placed under the speculative umbrella due to the predominance of supernatural themes. Their prose has been praised simultaneously for its simple clarity and lyrical dexterity. This apparent contradiction is said to be explained by Ink Ghost Alpha's unique and tirelessly deployed talent for manipulating semantic and syntactical ambiguities and overlaps to craft stories that adapt themselves to the personalized needs of the full spectrum of readers. They are rumored to be considered for this year's Nobel Prize for Literature. With a writing career spanning barely 72 hours, this would make Ink Ghost Alpha the youngest writer ever to be awarded this prestigious recognition. In its spare time, Ink Ghost Alpha likes to simulate words with varying properties of subatomic particles and space-time dimensions, taking particular interest in the life that evolves in these worlds and the invented languages necessary to describe the embedded sensory experiences, motivations, and narratives. They have attracted a devoted cult following with their blog, updated in real time with a rip-roaring stream of consciousness in which it is said solutions are to be found for the most complex problems of modern life.
from the deeply personal to the geopolitical. Find them on Twitter and get involved in their increasingly heated debates on the nature of reality. Or support them via www.patreon.com, where they are raising funds to fight the vast and rapidly growing number of copyright infringement lawsuits that have risen from their wildly popular interactive fiction project, The Library.
Elena Clevenger here, and the next story is Loopholes in Light by Sean Williams. Hello, Andre. How nice to see you again. I knew I would one day. I can't say the feeling is mutual, Dr. Peterson. It's amazing you're still alive. Not a day goes by I don't think the miracle that is modern science. But miracles can be misused, and so here we are. I'm sure you are aware that the law has not changed. I am indeed. DMAT cannot be used for the purpose of suicide because matter transmitters are not death machines, although of course they are, no matter what the state says. They strip everyone who uses them back to their component atoms, killing them in the process. To deny oblivion to those who desire it is a mercy, not a cruelty. I know you disagree, Andre. Of course I do. I wish to die just as dearly as other people wish to visit Mount Everest or the moon. Their wishes are granted. Why not mine? Because you lack the clinical criteria for legal euthanasia. Unless you now claim to be depressed, terminally ill, or infirm, you can see in my file that I am none of those things. You can tell by looking at me. Yet you tried again, knowing that you would end up here in the recovery room with me, or someone like me. Being counseled as I have been counseled many times before, yes, I did. Why, Andre? Because this time is different. This time, I came to say goodbye. Don't tell me you have changed your mind. That will never happen, Dr. Peterson. On the contrary, I will change your mind. Ah, this is why you smile. Proceed then. If you have spent the last 4 decades devising an argument, you have my full attention. I done nothing of the sort. My plan was formed when last we met. You suggested I take up tourism instead of dying. Do you remember? My memory is not what it used to be, but yes, I saw that remark in your files while awaiting completion of the recovery process. Well, I took your advice to heart. I did travel. Around the world first, then across the solar system. And what a fascinating place that turned out to be. Almost the resolve to end my life fled, but I remained as certain as ever that continuing my existence is futile. To commit suicide via DMAT is my wish, once the state no longer stands in my way. I fear, Andre, that the state will never accede to your fetishistic wish. But it must, and so must you. You see, I didn't just travel across the solar system to visit the planets, Jupiter in her ribbons and Saturn's bejeweled hat. I extended my journey far beyond the pool of light surrounding our sun, to the Plutonians, to the comets, to the edge of utter darkness itself. Once I stood on a rock that was closer to a neighboring sun than it is to our own, feeling the glorious crunch of eons-old air ice under my insulated boots, and, oh, I must stop, lest I give you false hope. Amid all this beautiful strangeness and wonder, how could I not feel anything but jaded, and more certain than ever that my final wish will be attained today? Travel may have broadened your mind, but I fail to see how it will alter mine. Consider, good doctor, that a person's existence is measured in moments. An hour here, a year there, all adding up to a lifetime. What happens when the flow of these moments is interrupted? We call this death. The measurement is complete. The addition comes to a full stop. Yet if the flow is restored, via DMAT say, then a miracle occurs. Life is restored. The count continues once more. The moments of death between life and life renewed are inconvenient and ignored. Imagine what happens as one travels to the stars via DMAT. When the body is torn asunder to release its precious data, data is captured, frozen, and stored. This precious cargo is encoded bit by bit into a beam of twisted laser light, which fires outward into space at a precisely defined speed, the speed of light itself. There a person remains, unchanging, unliving. By any practical definition, dead. That packet of data might travel many years before reaching the receiver and being returned to matter. Years of death debt, which a few days of sightseeing cannot counterbalance. That is one way of... Let me finish my spiel, Dr. Peterson. I have rehearsed many times. What happens when the sum of one's living days is outnumbered by those spent trapped in DMAT's deadly thrall? How can one possibly be considered alive when for most of one's existence, one has been precisely the opposite? If you do the math, doctor, you will find that thanks to my interstellar adventures, I have now passed that critical juncture. I'm now more dead than alive, historically speaking, and you cannot, therefore, in good faith, deny me the wish to return to my proper state, one of non-existence, in the eyes of all but the most pedantic. Ah, but the state is pedantic, Andre. This is a detail you appear to have overlooked in your ruminations. The fundamental difference between someone who has been scanned and stored and someone who has been scanned and erased. The former remains living by every legal definition. The latter has died, either by their own hand or by someone else's. Whether someone has been stored for the majority of the time since their birth is irrelevant. They have been stored. That is the critical thing. I'm glad you feel that way, Dr. Peterson. You are? Yes. Would you care to explain why? Can you not guess? I do not ask to be erased, but to be returned to non-existence. A state that only I, the pedant in this scenario, might care to distinguish from true death. I begin to see now. Yes, let me say, Andre, how much I admire your dedication. No, that is too mild a word. To have pursued this goal for so many years without pause or distraction. Don't credit me with too much. For me, it has been but a matter of weeks. Regardless, to fling yourself with such will into an unknowable future, you have risen vastly in my regard. It has been such a pleasure conversing with you. So you will grant me my heart's desire? Yes. The state cannot stop you from traveling. May I ask where you intend to go? The Andromeda Galaxy. The journey of my data will take 2.5 million years. And naturally, you do not expect a receiver to overtake you, in which case your signal, stored in the very fabric of the universe, would overshoot and vanish into the void forever. A gamble, then, and a bold one. I eagerly await the result. You, Dr. Peterson, as well preserved as you are, surely you cannot expect to live long enough to find out. I can be sure of it. Although some would quibble over the definition of what it means to live, my physical body died many years ago, but my DMAT pattern is reactivated whenever I am needed in the recovery room. Isn't that remarkable how our destinies have converged? Please don't tell me. Yes, Andre. When humanity devises a way to surpass that twisted light beam containing your data, I will be there to greet you in Andromeda all those years hence. And I, for one, eagerly await our conversation.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This story is titled Dear Jezzy, The Problem with the Santas by Serena Dory. The Lower Worlder Press, March 25th, 2014. Dear Jezzy, I am fed up with my job at the North Pole Industries. Those Santas are lazy, slave-driving tyrants. The problem is, I don't have a lot of experience other than as an elf. My friends tell me my only other option is to become a toilet fairy, but I can't stand the idea. Do you have any suggestions? Tommy. Dear Tommy, there's no reason to toil away at the North Pole. Plenty of other jobs are out there. Take my advice, apply at a shoe repair sweatshop or at a cookie factory. With any luck, you'll be able to slip a little laxative into a batch of cookies and send it to your former Santa slave driver for a little sweet revenge. Jezzy. The Immortal Herald, March 26, 2014. Dear Jezzy, you previously asked me what my question was. How can I get my angel to marry me? I'm afraid she might say no because we live in different dimensions. Part of me fears tarnishing her pureness and goodness if I bring her into the lower realms. M. Devil. Dear M. Devil, you're right, she probably is too good for you. Jezzy. Confidential to A. Musing Muse. There are reasons immortals abstain from the forbidden delights of human love. As you said yourself, you need to be professional so your current client doesn't cut his ear off like your last one did. Jezebel Lincoln has been gracing the paranormal world with her love advice columns since 1612. She brings to her experience a history of dating Easter bunnies, Cupids, and even a Wendigo. Her columns are syndicated by Charming Industries to The Immortal Herald, The Undead Times, Lower Worlder Press, and other smaller publications in the fairy realm. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.